Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And we still have not received the latest issue of the September-October Science of Mind magazine, but there are some excerpts in the newsletter that I'll share after a bit. So we will begin our program with some daily selections from Daily Word, published by Unity. And I haven't said this in a while, but whenever I read something that has the word God in it, please substitute whatever your belief or your word for your belief is, as in the universe or spirit and etc. So, brave. Through the power of God, of spirit, of the universe, within me, I am brave. If I want to have a greater, more expansive experience of life, I must be brave and move beyond the trepidation that holds me back. I do not judge myself for hesitating, but I don't let it stop me. Instead, I take my reluctance as a cue to call upon the strength of God, of spirit, of the universe within me, to push past my fear and move forward. So much life lies on the other side of my fear. I believe I am meant to live a fulfilling, satisfying life. Whether I am interested in having grand adventures or simply stepping out of my comfort zone and trying new things, I can rely on the divine within as I summon the courage to do new things. I affirm, I am brave. As this becomes the truth of my heart, my experience of life expands. Inner peace. The peace of God, Spirit, the universe, lives within me. The peace I want to feel in my mind and heart must begin with me. It's tempting to think that if I could control the outside world and the people in it, I could find serenity and calm. But external situations have the power to disturb my peace only if I let them. Having peace in my mind and heart is my sole responsibility and also my greatest freedom. It means I will not let the conditions of the world or the actions of others disturb my tranquility. By focusing on the abiding presence of God, of spirit, of the universe, and aligning my consciousness with it, I keep worldly matters in perspective. The things of the world will come and go, just as fortunes rise and fall. I accept life as it is, even as I strive to improve it. God's spirit, the universe's peace, is my peace forever. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, in an eagle's eye. The vastness of this endless sky is reflected in the corner of an eagle's eye. In just this way, the heart, when lifted up, reflects the universe. As the moon brings sun to those turned from the light, the opened heart brings love to those struggling through darkness. It is important to remember here that the moon is not the source of light, but a reflection. And likewise, as magnificent as the heart is, it is not the source of love, but a conveyor of forces often out of view when we are struggling. I've come to realize that the people I've admired throughout my life, the ones I've tried to emulate, were all like the moon appearing in the night. And though I secretly wanted to be like these wonderful people, it was their openness that allowed them to shine in the middle of my darkness. An openness I didn't need to copy or envy, just uncover in myself. I think of my grandmother, whose huge immigrant warmth enabled me to see myself, the way a full moon lets you see your hands in the dark. And there was the one teacher with the golden eye who held truth in the air before our confused young egos, and somehow it relaxed me into finding what really matters. And there was a 70-year-old priest who led my wellness group, so genuine in his love that his heart reflected everything with equal detail and compassion, our pain and grace, our fear and hope, our confusion and certainty. All this to somehow say that to care is to rise above things without leaving them. When we care, we receive the truth that lives beneath words, and the sense of what is too much to say then reflects off our hearts, soothing those around us. Sit with a trusted loved one and describe the heart of someone you admire. How have you benefited from this person's grace? Where does this grace live in you? Can you benefit yourself? Meditate together on the quality of heart you admire and invite it to show itself through you. And we turn now to a couple of articles from the Science of Mind newsletter for 9/8 25. The first one by Eugene Holden, Find Your Transcendent Purpose. Your transcendent purpose is your soul's compass, an internal, unshakable sense of direction that reaches beyond ego, achievement, or personal gratification. It is the sacred thread woven through the tapestry of our existence, connecting the ordinary to the eternal. Unlike a career or a calling, your transcendent purpose arises not from your mind or societal roles, but instead from the deep well of being, often revealed through stillness, struggle, surrender, or spiritual awakening. Your transcendent purpose literally transcends your identity. It is not about who you are in the world, but instead it is about what wants to move through you, as you. Serving your transcendent purpose is not just about doing, it is about being. You become the space where the divine's intention becomes incarnate. You become the present that lifts up others by existing in integrity with the infinite. Your transcendent purpose is what remains when roles fall away, what endures when accolades fade. It is the soul's signature echoing through time, creating ripples that outlast a lifetime. You are here on purpose, for a purpose, the infinite desire to express itself by means of you. Now is the time, and you are the one. This was excerpted from Your Purpose, Desire, Intention, and Commitment in the September 2025 Science of Mind magazine. And the other selection is by Ernest Holmes, Practice the Presence of God, of Spirit, of the Universe. We must first become convinced that love is a principle of nature. We have ample evidence, scientifically, logically, intuitionally, and inspirationally, that there is no need for anyone in the world today to speak of love as a mere idle sentimentality. What you need to do is fall so deeply in love that you will surrender that confounded, egotistical, pig-headed intellectual concept that each of us lives alone. God is the soul of everyone. God is the mind of everyone. God is the self of everyone, and God is the lover of every soul. Therefore, we have to begin to practice the presence of God, of Spirit, of the Universe, as love, as friendship, as peace, as joy. Love alone shall discover the heart of God at the heart of humanity. Love alone shall reveal the self to the self and find it enthroned in the high citadel of the secret place of God, of Spirit, of the Universe. In our own hearts, that beneficence, that inevitable, that divine weakness that speaks to the universe and sings the lips of the mother with the child, falls in love and gradually learns to love the whole world, while the arena of its activity is no longer confined to littleness, but, having broken down the qualms and limits of that which has restricted, takes the same love and extends it to everything and everyone. And as surely as it does, it shall hear a song that may be eternally sung in the spaces of nature. It must be what to you and to me comes only when we have listened. It comes only when we have loved, for the circuit is not complete until we enter into it and in cooperation with the eternal God, Spirit, Universe, we give. And this was excerpted from The World Cries Out for Love, published in the September 2025 Science of Mind magazine, which I'm hoping to have by the time we do next week's program. We turn now to the September-October issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication. And we're going to share Rabbi Rami Shapiro's monthly column of question and answers, Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler. Much Ado About Miracles. Question. I'm reading Paramahansa Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi, a must-read for spiritual seekers. Yet he seems quite gullible about his guru's miracles. On the other hand, I never question Christ's miracles in the Gospels. Am I just biased? Rabbi Rami. The miracles in both books may be true, or they may be false, or maybe it doesn't matter. In the book of Acts, we learn that God is that reality in whom we live and move and have our being. All life is divine life, and every event is miraculous. The key isn't to accept or reject the miracles reported by others, but to recognize the miracles that occur in and around you at every moment. Question. My family says they love me, but things have been strained since I came out as a lesbian. James Baldwin wrote that we can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist. Mr. Baldwin allows me to stop loving my parents, but the Bible commands me to love them. Whom should I follow? Rabbi Rami. As far as I know, this was a 2015 tweet by Robert Jones Jr., not James Baldwin. The Bible doesn't instruct you to love your parents, but to honor them. The Apostle Paul stated that honoring your parents means obeying them. His rabbinic contemporaries said it means caring for them in old age. Honor your parents by ensuring their well-being. Honor yourself by loving whomever you choose. Question. My Buddhist friends tell me I don't exist, that the self, myself, is an illusion. But this is silly. As Descartes said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Am I wrong? Rabbi Rami. What if you're wrong? Fallo ergo sum, I'm wrong, therefore I am. It's just as convincing as cogito ergo sum. Why? Because the I, the thinker, the self, is a byproduct of thinking. When thoughts arise, one of those thoughts is, I am thinking these thoughts. Stop thinking and the thinker ceases as well. Of course, the only way you know you've stopped thinking is when the thought, I've stopped thinking, arises and the whole mess starts over again. If you're worried that you don't exist, just keep arguing with your Buddhist friends. The argument itself will guarantee that you do exist. Question. I'm an atheist, but I like the idea of heaven. Is access to heaven closed to me? Rabbi Rami. The ancient rabbis taught that entry to heaven depends on 6 God-free criteria. 1, honest relationships. 2, lifelong learning. 3, raising children as a parent, relative, teacher, and so on. 4, maintaining hope. 5, engaging in meaningful conversation. And 6, learning to distinguish right from wrong. If you live according to these criteria, you'll be just fine. Question. I recently bought a telescope for my granddaughter and me to explore the night sky. Her parents are anti-religion, but I want to instill in her a sense of the sacred without indoctrinating her in a specific religion. What do you think? Rabbi Rami, planetariums ought to be the ashrams of the 21st century. A careful examination of the cosmos leads to a profound realization of God, but not a brand name God encumbered by theology, clergy, institutions, politicians, and too often armies. The universe is a non-dual, complex, dynamic, interdependent happening called by many names: Tao, Brahman, Allah, Mother, Yeshiva, Reality, Kali, and so on, that carries an ethic of reciprocity. What is hateful to you, do not do to others. Few religions teach this. If you can instill this in your granddaughter, brava. Question. My sister is obsessed with C.S. Lewis's trilemma. When Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me. Is he a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord? She says this is irrefutable. Jesus is Lord. How would you respond to her? Rabbi Rami. I would present her with Rabbi Rami's trilemma. When Krishna states, I am the one, the many, the all-pervading, the all-encompassing, is he a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord? Since Jesus and Krishna express the same idea, if you claim Krishna is a liar, I will claim Jesus is a liar. If you assert Krishna is a lunatic, I will assert Jesus is a lunatic. If you declare that Krishna is Lord, I will declare that Jesus is Lord. So, which is it? Question. I heard a story about a cat who, moments before dying, lifted a paw to her owner as if to say goodbye, and then walked to her bed and passed away. Doesn't this demonstrate a level of consciousness on par with humans? And if it does, shouldn't we grant animals human rights? Rabbi Rami. Everything is an extension of God, sharing consciousness and intelligence, albeit to various degrees. I have no problem believing this cat demonstrated love, gratitude, and self-awareness toward her human companion as she died. However, I would not base rights on this. This cat exhibited a level of consciousness superior to that of human newborns, yet I would not deprive newborns of rights simply because they do not measure up to cats. All beings deserve to be treated with the utmost respect, regardless of their level of sentience. Question. You write extensively about awakening to our unity with God or reality, and many of us express a desire to be enlightened or transcend our mundane nature. But if we do awaken, what difference does it make? Rabbi Rami. Waking up to our oneness with reality means realizing our interdependence with and obligation to all life. It means recognizing that some suffering is natural to life and doing what we can to alleviate it. It means recognizing that most suffering is the product of human behavior rooted in ignorance, fear, and greed, and doing what we can to free ourselves from the isms and ideologies that promote it. Question. My goal is to be present, to be here now, but I'm not having much luck. Do you have any suggestions? Rabbi Rami. Stop trying. The you that wants to be present is a product of the past. You is a construct of memory. Memory is always in the past. There is no you in the here and now. When someone claims to be present in the moment, they're lying. For the moment they're talking about is already past, and with it, their claim to being present. Don't worry about being here now. Concern yourself with being just and kind wherever you happen to be and whenever you happen to be there. And from the same issue, an article by Louisa Rogers, Holy Whispers. The divine communicates with us through physical sensations, precisely when and how we need it most. So, do you love him? My new friend Rachel asked. You sound so casual, I kind of wondered. We were eating pizza in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the him she was referring to was my new husband, who was out of town. I hesitated, not knowing quite what to say. It had been a rough 8 months, with an enormous amount of upheaval, since we had married. In truth, I was relieved he was out of town so I could reflect on my growing doubts about our marriage. Today, 45 years later, Barry and I chuckle ruefully when people ask us the secret to our long-term marriage, and we reply only half-jokingly, "Skip the first year." I took a bite of pizza, still not sure how to respond, when suddenly I felt a frisson of sensation, a powerful shudder that was almost a chill across my upper back and right shoulder. "Yes," I said, looking straight at her. "Yes, I do love Barry." That was my first awareness of the sudden, unmistakable knowledge of a presence working in my life, letting me know in that most intimate of places, my body. It isn't always a shiver. Sometimes I experience the sacred as tears, sweat, saliva, tingling, laughing, sighing, or a touch. A rich variety of powerful physical sensations expressed through the portal of my body. I've only had a few experiences like the holy shiver in my life, but whenever they happen, I'm always jolted awake. Here are some other times when the divine has whispered its presence to me. Holy hugging. During my junior high school years, my family lived in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. One Saturday in April, I invited a girl I admired who I'd met in Girl Scouts to come over. I liked Sue, but I was a bit intimidated by her. She was in the smart class and had even backpacked with her family in the Grand Tetons, something I couldn't imagine doing. That afternoon, we hung out in our backyard, chatting and playing on the swings. I was relieved to feel very relaxed around her because she was so unassuming and down to earth. I was so relaxed, in fact, that later, as we walked down our suburban street, I spontaneously put my arm around her and said, "I like you." It was a worthwhile risk because she hugged me right back, and we both grinned and laughed as we carried on walking down the street, two girls, arm in arm. Holy tears. When I was 16, I spent my last 2 years of high school at a girls' Episcopalian boarding school in Raleigh, North Carolina, while my parents and younger siblings were living in Pakistan, where my dad had been assigned as a diplomat. Surprisingly, moving to the South was a far greater culture shock than Pakistan had been, and I felt deeply lonely and like a complete misfit. The other girls were everything I was not, cute, slim, and confident in their villager blouses and papagallo shoes. I wasn't particularly religious either, and would sit in the chapel during Sunday services, irritated by how superficial and false all the rituals seemed. One Sunday morning, during the choir procession, I noticed that a choir member whom I didn't recognize had a strongly pronounced limp. Like me, she was different. But unlike me, she was smiling and singing lustily as she lumbered along, messing up the symmetry of the choir's pace. As I stared at her limping down the aisle, the critical thoughts in my head disappeared, and I felt suddenly at peace with everything around me. The other girls in their fancy dresses, the wooden pews, the hymns. Sitting there, humbled, tears came to my eyes. I'm never ashamed of weeping. Just as the earth needs rain, our bodies need tears. Holy Voice. Not long after my mother died in the late 70s, I visited my father and younger siblings who were still living at home. Late one night, my sister got irritated with me. "Oh, Wheeze," she said, using her pet name for me as she sighed. "Do you have to go on like this?" I remember nothing of the incident, except that I simply couldn't bear her not liking me at that moment. I was so distraught, I couldn't even stay in the same room with her. Silently, I put on my coat and headed out into the cold nighttime air and walked down the snowy block, trembling not from the cold, but from my intense anxiety. After a few minutes, something completely unpredictable and shocking happened. The still small voice within spoke to me. "It's okay, sweetie," said the voice. "It's okay." A sense of palpable calm arrived and rested on my shoulders as though someone had gently placed a shawl around me. That moment on the cold Pennsylvania street was my first experience of the spiritual insight that nothing can change without our first accepting what is. I turned around, went back inside, and rejoined my siblings. All was well. I didn't have to explain where I'd gone, because they thought I'd been getting ready for bed. Holy Sigh. 30 years ago, I was wrestling with letting go of the last remnants of my anguish from a sexual trauma I'd experienced as a young adult. No matter how hard I'd tried, I hadn't been able to completely shake off the pain. One cloudy afternoon, after obsessing about the incident and hoping to feel better, I drove to a duck pond in Palo Alto, California, where my husband and I were living at the time. While sitting in my car, downheartedly watching the ducks, I noticed a group of disabled children scampering along a nearby path, laughing and being silly, accompanied by a young man who joked with them and seemed very affectionate. Their innocent tenderness was contagious. Surrounded by the water, the ducks, the young man, and the kids, I felt my shoulders relax, and I sighed deeply as though I was exhaling the last few molecules of pain. And indeed, just like that, I let go of the wound and have rarely felt any suffering about my trauma since. Holy Gasp. Like everyone else, I get caught up in the humdrum details of daily living. But a few months ago, I had an experience that awakened me from the tedium of routine and reminded me what a wondrous gift it is to be alive. I was walking barefoot on the beach, one of my greatest pleasures, near our home in California, when suddenly a crowd of sandpipers flew right over my head. It was such a shock, I gasped loudly. They were so close they almost touched me, and they were so beautiful in their elegant gossamer formation, looking like an enormous crocheted bedspread in flight. I gazed at them in awe as they whooshed away. That one moment has stayed with me ever since. Holy Mothering Embrace. When I was in my late 20s, a therapist I was working with asked me to bring photos of myself as a little girl to our session. I found one of when I was about 3 years old, looking very forlorn, as my two older sisters, smiling and oblivious of my angst, left for school. How I had longed to be one of the big girls. My therapist told me to imagine holding my three-year-old self. As I consoled young Louisa, I wept copiously. I loved her so much. What a sweetheart she was. Of course she wanted to be included. Still crying, I visualized rocking her tenderly in my arms. Afterward, as I sat in a state of deep, restful calm, my therapist said, "Visualizing can be very healing." What an understatement. Cradling my child self was a transformative moment, my first experience, but not my last, of treating young Louisa with such complete, undiluted kindness. In a perfect world, these cherished encounters with the sacred would materialize whenever I want, but of course, they're not within my control. I can encourage them, though. I've learned that the more I put myself in situations where I welcome the presence, like being as honest and undefended as I was with my friend Sue, or spending time outdoors, as at the duck pond or at the ocean, the greater the likelihood that I will experience such a gift. But ultimately, these gifts are a mystery. In none of these situations did I do anything in particular to make them happen. I wasn't even looking for them. In fact, I might have had the exact same circumstances, like be walking on the beach when a flock of birds flew over me, and instead of gazing at them in awe, be texting a friend or talking on the phone, and would have missed them altogether. Happily, I didn't have my phone at the beach. Maybe that's the key. Leaving my phone in the car was a way of being open to presence. We can't force the magic, but we can be open to it. And maybe that's no small thing in the crowded and jangled lives many of us lead. Be open, and we might just get lucky and experience a rare moment of grace. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. We return now to Channeled Messages from Deep Space, Wisdom for a Changing World by Mike Dooley and with Tracy Farquhar, who channels Frank, a group of beings from another universe, another planet, who've learned how to travel through space without spaceships and without their bodies. And they go to other planets to help beings that are going through similar things that they have and offer some very helpful advice. And we were in the last section asking better questions. So Mike says, what 10 questions would I be wise to ask you and how would you answer them? And we had gotten to number 6. How does one make peace with their physical body when it seems to cause them so much pain, struggle, or even disgust? What do they need to do to feel the true blessing of their physical nature and stop struggling with it? The first step is to understand that you do not struggle against your own intrinsic ideas of what your physical form should look or act like, but against a learned ideal that is culturally conditioned and based on the whims of a few who decide that they can dictate the way a society perceives beauty and worthiness. This self-critical nature stems from a belief system that says we have to conform to these cultural standards, and if we don't, we will be cast out. In actuality, it is you who do the casting out. Because physical beings rely so much on their 5 senses to experience reality, there's a lot of emphasis on the way things look. These visual cues are what keep you safe. They will keep you away from things that repulse you and draw you to things that are intrinsically attractive. There are built-in instincts within the brains of all creatures to respond to that which is perceived with the 5 senses, and it is by design that you are naturally attracted to some things and compelled to avoid others. There are, however, some aspects of this process that are learned, such as the idea of beauty. When you examine other cultures and time periods, you will find that the standards of beauty shift and change, especially when it comes to what is considered desirable in the human form. We would suggest that you consider this and ask where this standard originates. Is it an instinctual function of the brain, or is it another learned belief based on what is culturally accepted as truth? Can you override these learned beliefs and create your own that are more resonant with what you believe to be true about beauty and the nature of the human form? Herein lies the struggle between what you know to be true in your heart and what is conditioned as truth in your thinking. Your 5 senses tend toward the latter. They're directly connected to the intellectual process of logic and reason, and it is in those brain functions that you will find the learned belief systems that has become an automatically programmed truth. But just as you can alter the programming of a computer, you can alter the programming of the brain to accept a different truth, one that is more resonant with your soul's wisdom and the calling of your heart. Self-love is not something that is learned in your human culture. In fact, it is usually taught as something to be avoided. It is considered sinful and vain, and children are admonished at an early age to avoid being self-centered and self-important. And so the brain is programmed from an early age to focus on that which is flawed and needing improvement, and that which is ugly and needing to be hidden or corrected. Thus, it becomes a habit to see only that which is wrong with the body when one looks at oneself. It is important to understand the psychology behind this self-criticism. The learned belief that has programmed the brain not only creates a way of thinking, it creates a way of seeing the visual representation of the self. This means that what you are perceiving as yourself is a false image, viewed through the filter of a false belief system and projected onto your visual cortex as reality. You have been convinced that your eyes don't lie, but in truth, it is the interpretation of that light reflection back to the brain that is flawed, as it is being skewed by a belief system that is set to interpret any image of the self as defective. Here are some exercises you can practice that can assist in the reprogramming of the belief system, thereby creating a different sense and truth about beauty and how you perceive the image of yourself. Begin to become more aware of how you view the beauty of the ones you love. When you look at a child or a dear friend or a family member, what is it that you are seeing? Do you find yourself automatically finding those aspects of their human form that are beautiful? Or are you seeking flaws? Can you acknowledge that which your society deems as defective and find the beauty in it? Do you see how your eyes will be drawn to the beauty of a loved one's face and physical form, and even find beauty in those things that your society may not dictate as beautiful? With that knowledge in mind, look at yourself in the mirror and observe the difference in the way you view yourself. Are you seeking beauty or flaws? Do your eyes naturally look for that which needs improvement or that which is desirable? Can you find the beauty in your own perceived flaws? And now, while the results of this exercise are fresh in your mind, create a journal entry that consists of four lists. The first list will be what you find beautiful about the physical aspect of a loved one. The second list will be what you find to be flawed about that person. The third and fourth lists will be what you find beautiful and flawed about yourself. Observe these lists, meditate on them, and set the intention that they become more balanced in their perspective. Focusing on the lists about you, see if you can move one thing each day from the list of flaws onto the list of beauty. Do not just do this as a rote exercise. Really focus on each thing that you find as flawed and feel its intrinsic beauty. Each time you move one item over, bless it, make peace with it, love the beauty within the flaw, and set the intention to release the programmed judgment that creates so much struggle within you. Also, set the intention through this exercise to understand the value of perspective. When one is in the midst of a life crisis or tragedy, one can only respond with emotion and cannot see the lesson or gift within the circumstance. It is only through time that perspective can be gained and the gift revealed. The same holds true with the image of the self. When one is experiencing life in the first person, one is often blind to the external perspective, which can be much softer, kinder, and wiser. Here is where detachment is key, allowing yourself to detach from that which you have learned to be truth, creating a new truth that is more in line with the truth you hold for others, and practicing a perspective that steps outside the programmed intellect and into the higher truth that will reset the reactive visual interpretation of the self into a more truthful image of that which is beautiful, divine, and representative of the universal soul being. 7. What is the best way to find balance in my life? There never seems to be enough time to do all the things I want to do. How can I create the time? Here again, you must become clear about what you want. It is all well and good to desire a more balanced life, but if you are asking for balance and yet fearful of letting go of anything in your life, your attempts at creating time for the things you'd like to manifest will not be very successful. Understand that physical beings often hold on to physical things out of fear. They will also hold on to responsibilities, relationships, obligations, and habits because these things have become part of their identity, and they fear who they will become without even one of those things. However, holding on to a lot of extraneous things that do not resonate with you can only create an anchor to the past that will keep you from moving forward into your future and enjoying what is right now. If you are feeling that your life and time are unbalanced, it is essential that you look at where you are spending your time and energy with the intention of lightening the load. This may cause some fear, as you will resist letting go of anything that appears to be a means to an end. However, it is essential that you find ways to cut back the amount of time you are spending on those things that can be delegated to others or eliminated altogether. Often the imbalance is created by a lack of self-care and a failure to include recreation and rest in your schedule with the same amount of priority as work. When work and income become the primary goals in deciding how you spend your days, you will find that eventually you will begin to feel resentful of this neglect, resulting in fatigue, irritability, and discontent. It is essential to the health of the mind, body, and spirit that you tend to their needs with just as much care as you tend to others and your work. The importance of lighthearted and creative activities cannot be emphasized enough. Without them, you may begin to feel a sense of malaise and disappointment. The spirit within you cries out for peaceful interludes that nurture and care for it, and for creative expression, even if that expression never amounts to anything more than a hobby. And so, if you find that you're spending an inordinate amount of time on obligations, work, and caring for others, and a disproportionately small amount of time on yourself, you may want to ask yourself these questions. 1. How can I better manage my day so that I get more accomplished in a shorter amount of time? Is it possible to consolidate some of my obligations or delegate them to someone else? 2. Can I schedule at least one day per week that is devoted solely to myself and my family? Can I make sure to stick to the policy of no work on this day, unless it is an emergency? 2. Can I schedule at least one day per week that is devoted solely to myself and my family? Can I make sure to stick to the policy of no work on this day, unless it is an emergency? 3. Can I find at least a few minutes at the end of the day to journal about my feelings, my desires, and my intentions? This can be very helpful in drawing your highest good toward you. It will also distract you from some of the worries and concerns that may be the outcome of an overworked individual. 4. Is there a way to integrate some self-care into my daily schedule? Can I spend 2 minutes of a bathroom break in meditation? Can I take a walk at lunchtime? Can I call or text to connect with a loved one sometime during the day simply because I know it will pick me up? Can I be sure to take frequent stretch and bend breaks from sitting at my keyboard for hours on end? You also need to be sure that you are balancing your home life with your social life and your intellect with your heart. The first step is to make peace with where you are. Be grateful for your busy life, as it means you are attracting many opportunities for fulfillment and appreciation, and that you have achieved a sense of being needed and appreciated. The second step is to learn to say no to those opportunities that weigh heavily on you and become burdensome. If you've already scheduled time for yourself and another invitation arrives, be sure that you are seeing that scheduled time as a priority and that you do not fall into the trap of constantly putting the needs of others before your own. Learning to say no to opportunities that will overburden you or that simply do not resonate with you, setting clear time constraints on projects and activities so that you are getting a lot done within a short amount of time, delegating things that do not have to be in your control, asking for help when it is needed, making self-care a priority, and finding time throughout your day for continual self-care are all ways to achieve a more balanced, productive, and fulfilled life. 8. Where do our loved ones in spirit go, and why do they have to leave us? How can we make peace with our grief and the pain of missing their presence in our lives? We would like to make this very clear. The act of death is not a leaving. It is a transformation. Your loved ones have not abandoned you, no matter what it feels like to you without their physical presence. They have shed the physical form because it was time for them to do so. Whether you choose to accept that truth or not, there is no one right way, time, or method to die. All of them are right, and all death occurs at the exact right time for the individual and with the full consent of the soul. The challenge here has to do with the pain of the physical loss of a loved one. It is in the longing for their presence in your life that you struggle, and within that struggle may come a railing against the unfairness of it, an angst toward a God who would dare to take this person's life away from them, and a fearful reminder of one's own mortality. It is because you hold life as so precious that you feel that the ending of it is a tragedy, and that what you would consider an untimely death is a travesty, a theft of something precious, the ultimate deception of God against human. And it is true that your physical life is a precious gift, an opportunity to revel in all the joys, pains, and sorrows that will enhance and enrich your soul, to bask in the beauty of your planet, to experience the physical delights of the senses, and to love and be loved. But your vision here is quite limited, as you fail to take into account that you are at your core a spirit being who has decided to inhabit the physical in a temporary way before returning to your natural state. Understand that all that you experience here is temporary by design. Having the opportunity for constant change ensures that you have the best chance of evolving, learning, and growing into the realization of your own creative power, and that you can experience the healing of grief, pain, and loss as you move forward in time and create a new way of living. It is not an easy thing to make peace with the passing of a loved one, as you will feel their absence as pain. But if you can come to terms with the truth that these loved ones have returned to their natural state in a sacred and divine dimensional space that is full of beauty, love, and grace, and from which they can still see you, commune with your energy, and support your journey, you may find that your grief is softened and that your sadness is less all-encompassing with time. We would suggest that you set the intention to create a different relationship with the concept of death and understand that the way you've been taught to view it is not necessarily the truth. As you come to understand that all things in this physical existence are transient, that they will ebb and flow with the tides, and that nothing in the physical can be fully grasped and anchored in place, you will more easily make peace with the nature of all things, people, and experiences in your life as they flow through you. Every experience, every person, and every challenge presents the opportunity for divine expression and connection, especially in the death of a loved one who passes into the true divine essence of their soul as they transition back to their original state and shed the heaviness of the physical being. Understand that just as the energy of the soul and spirit is eternal, so is the energy of love, and that no perceived slights, hurts, or conflicts will be carried over into the spirit realm, as these things have no place there. As the physical shell is shed, so are all maladies, pains, and restrictions of the body, as well as any suffering, confusion, or trauma. Your loved ones do not sit in judgment of you, nor do they feel anger or disappointment with anything that happened while they were in the physical experience. They only feel love, even if they never express that love in their lifetime. Love is all that's left when the negativity of a wounded ego is shed. We would suggest that when you are experiencing the grief of loss, that you take some time to imagine your loved ones transitioning into their natural state of energetic spirit. Can you visualize them free and unencumbered, with great joy in their reunion with their own loved ones in spirit, and free of any physical, emotional, or mental pain that was experienced in their lifetime? Can you feel the joy in this transition and know that they're not only at peace, but in a state of euphoria like nothing you could experience on earth? Can you imagine the beauty of this transition as it is filled with loving energy, divine beings, and a joyful welcome home? Here, then, is the truth of death. It is a joyous occasion for all, and one that is filled with light. And if you can bring just a bit of that light into your heart as you grieve, you will most assuredly find comfort. Your loved ones do not need you to honor them with your grief. They want to see you happy and moving forward with the adventure of your life. Holding on to your sadness is not a way to remember them. They wish you to remember the joyful times you had with them on this plane of existence and understand that their joy in their transition state far transcends any joy they could have experienced here on the physical plane. There is no need for you to treat your grief as a cloak that prevents you from enjoying the richness of your own life. This is not to say that you will not miss the physical presence of your loved one and feel periods of sadness, but understand that you can transcend this sadness and focus on the joy of gratitude that they chose to share their life with you for whatever amount of time that was allowed, and create a legacy of the love and happiness that you shared while they were here. Grief will come. Sadness will come. Loss will come. They are inevitable aspects of the physical experience. The choice that you are being offered is about what you will do with these emotions, how you will allow them to shape your life and soul, what you will find out about yourself through these feelings, and how, through your connection to divine will and source energy, you will carry on, thrive, and return to happiness. 9. How do I get back in touch with the child in me who used to experience life as a joyful adventure, full of wonder and love? How do I, as an adult, become childlike again? Just as your soul is the embodiment of all aspects of your being, all lifetimes, all dimensional spaces, all personalities and experiences, your spirit, which animates the physical in this lifetime, is the embodiment of all ages, all experiences, and all stages of evolution within the lifetime. As such, the child is very much alive and well within you. It has simply been pushed aside by the need to fulfill obligations, become a responsible adult, and reflect a persona that is mature and serious. We would very much like to advocate that you commune with this childlike aspect of your being on a daily basis. We are drawn to the energy of children because of the pure and bright energy that surrounds them. They are motivated by curiosity and wonder and the desire to feel joy and connection. They spend very little time absorbed in the past or worried about the future, and can become so acutely focused on the present moment in the act of creative play that all else around them fades into the background. It is in those moments that their physical, mental, and spiritual aspects are fully engaged in a harmonic act of self-expression, and they are building upon that creative act as part of the creation of life itself. It is here that source energy speaks through us in the creative aspect of being, whether that creative act produces a crayon drawing or a great work of art, a toy assemblage or a suspension bridge, an imagined meal or a feast for thousands. The energy that surrounds the creative act is the divine expression of source at its finest, and even when we are simply witnesses to this energy, we are moved. Here, then, is the key. The act of playful creation comes naturally to children and to the childlike aspect that continues to live within your being. We would encourage you to explore this aspect of yourself on a regular basis. What creative spark lives within you? Was there once something you loved to do but gave it up in favor of more practical pursuits? Did you once love to draw or sculpt or play music? Did you spend hours creating dialogues between your toys or imagining great adventures in the park? Did you transform the elements around you into a beautiful land of mystical marvels and mythical creatures? And do you ever find yourself being pulled into similar daydreams now, only to push them aside as frivolous or a waste of time? No act of creativity is ever wasted. Make no mistake about that. It is within those moments of creativity that we are able to engage with the divine and create a flow of energy that allows us to experience ourselves as masters of our life's experience and extensions of the supreme creative energy of Source. Playing expands your energetic field and creates a feeling of euphoric joy, and within that emotional and energetic state lies the key to the transformation of your life toward the highest aspects of your being. It ignites the processes of the brain and integrates those processes with the calling of the heart, which is the expression of the spirit. It is what arranges the energetic qualities of matter into reality and aligns the circumstances of life into action. Never underestimate the power of this force, as it is what helped to create you as you are today. And so we would recommend that you bring more playtime into your life. Any act of creativity can be considered play, whether it is artistic, literary, verbal, culinary, constructive, physical, or mental. Passive entertainment, such as listening to music or watching TV, are restful, but creating your own music or stories is active, and it is within this action that you truly engage the creative aspect of yourself. Do it more. Make something, no matter how well you think you can do it. Make something without judgment, just for the sheer joy of it. Make something until you develop a passion for making it that will then translate into the passion for creating your life, creating joy, creating love. Make something until you realize that this is who you are and why you came here, to create, to choose, to form your life with your own will and your own divine spark. You are a creator, a maker, a divine extension of all the creative energy of the universe. What are you going to do with this supreme power? We would highly recommend that you find a way to have fun with it. And it is within that fun that you will once again engage the child within in wonder and amazement for all that this life has to offer you. 10. How do I access truth? How do I know what is truthful and real when there is so much untruth surrounding me? Just as a child lives within you, so does all knowing, all wisdom, and all truth. As you are at your core, a direct extension of Source, of universal wisdom, of the all-knowing mind. So even though this wisdom is not always apparent to you, it is there. It is available, and it can be accessed to help guide you through the path of your life. You may have had experiences in your life where you've witnessed the sage wisdom of a child whose physical nature seems to portray a helplessness and dependency on the maturity of an adult to guide her. This child may have surprised you on occasion with some supreme wisdom about the nature of life, or some resonant truth that shook you to the core and made you think of yourself or your life in a different way. This child was, in that moment, connecting with that inner wisdom to that infinite source of knowing without the filter of learned beliefs and the self-protective ego. There can be much wisdom gained through the open channel of a child. And so you can see that as we mature, we accumulate a great deal of false beliefs and heavy trappings of ego that block out our innate connection to divine wisdom and truth. We place great obstacles in the way of this free-flowing energetic connection, and then we wonder why it is that we're having difficulty figuring out our lives. The wisdom that you believe to be practical and intellectual, while it has its place in the world, is not usually your best guide when it comes to connecting with your soul's path and fulfilling the joyful trajectory that you planned for this life. Understand that every time you find a reason why you cannot fulfill a dream to follow the calling of your heart, you are blocking that inner wisdom. Every time you judge yourself to be unworthy or not good enough, you are constructing more walls to your energetic connection to the truth. Every time you look to another person, achievement, or possession to create happiness in your life, you are ignoring what you know to be true about needing to first create within what you wish to experience in the external world. Whenever you find yourself mired in the intellectual and practical aspects of your life, you are ignoring that energetic aspect that is your direct line to truth and wisdom. Therefore, it is imperative that you find a way to stretch your thinking into the realms of the unknown, that you extend your focus beyond that which you can experience with the five senses, that you feel the energetic and emotional expressions of yourself just as authentically as you feel the physical, and that you experience this energy through gratitude, through joy, and through the loving nature of your spirit being. The freedom that you can experience by breaking down the walls of conformed thinking is what will lead you to the truth of who you are and why you are here. In other words, stop trying so hard to figure it all out. Your brain was not created for this pastime. It is the processor that allows you to make sense of the physical experience. It is not designed to grasp the non-physical nature of being, as it is, by its very nature, intrinsically physical and rooted in its physically generated energy. While it is an amazing and miraculous part of your being, it is limited just by the nature of its physicality, and therefore it will limit your experience if you rely solely on it to guide and inform you. Beyond the thinking brain lies the energetic nature of your being. Consider this. You would not rely on the physical nature of a wire to define its purpose. It is the electricity flowing through the wire that is the intrinsic truth of the nature of the wire. Without that energy, it is simply physical matter that takes up space. But with that energy, it is a conduit for light, for motion, for creative action. Your brain and the rest of your physical body are like that wire. While they are miraculous feats of creation in and of themselves, it is the energy that runs through them that defines the nature of their purpose. And so, restricting your comprehension of the nature of reality and the truth of being to that which you have learned, that which you can see, and that which you can experience comfortably is ignoring an entire realm of being that goes beyond what you can easily comprehend or explain in a logical way. Embrace that fact, that there will be things you cannot comprehend within the limitations of the physical brain, but that you can feel as resonant truth. There are moments of inspired intuition that defy the logic of scientific thought, but that bring you to a state of grace and wisdom that cannot be achieved solely through the workings of the brain. You have experienced these moments of insight and intuition at various times in your life, and you have probably found a way to explain them in a logical sense so that you are more comfortable with them. But the reality is that it is within these moments that you are truly connected with the divine, energetic aspect of who you really are. This is why meditation and other forms of mindfulness are so effective in helping you experience that energetic connection. As you focus on being in the moment, as you retrieve your thoughts from dwelling in the past or future, as you allow your frequency to rise and connect, you will discover that this clear channel was always open to you, and that once you clear away the blockages to it, you will find that it is more easily accessible to help guide and comfort you on your path. This does not mean, however, that those who practice mindfulness will never find themselves at odds with their path and in a state of quandary or indecision, for it is within these states that you are able to exercise your divine will to make choices. If these choices are based solely on what you can see and what you can think, they may not always lead you to your intended state of being. This, in and of itself, is not an error, for it will be part of the journey toward an evolved state of being. But as you find yourself in a place on your path that is not resonant with your inner sense of truth, it is important to acknowledge how you arrived there and what sense of inner knowing you were ignoring along the way. We all receive intuitive information on a regular basis. This is the knowing force that gives us a sense of resonance with truth. We will feel that someone is not who they appear to be, or that a situation is not as it seems. We will feel the energy of a connection as being beneficial or not, despite what the intellect is telling us. We will sense that something needs to be avoided, or that something is calling us forward that is not based on a logical process. It is through the quiet acknowledgement of these feelings and senses that we can more strongly connect with the innate truths of our soul's wisdom, and we can quiet the alarms of logical thought that are not always in our best interest and that can steer us away from our inner truths. We come now to the end of our program. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.